Today's Teisho is on Case 56 in the Book of Serenity, Spiritual Uncle Me and the Rabbit. Introduction. Better to be sunk forever than to seek the liberation of the saints. Devadatta experienced the bliss of the third meditation heaven while in uninterrupted hell. Rudraka Ramaputra fell from the heaven of the summit of existence into the body of a flying wildcat. Tell me, where is the gain and the loss? Case. As Dong Shan and his spiritual uncle Mi were walking along, they saw a white rabbit run by in front of them. Mi said, "Swift." Dong Shan said, "How?" Mi said, "It's like a commoner being made into a prime minister." Dong Shan said, "Such a venerable old person as you still says such words?" Mi said, "Then what about you?" Dong Shan said, "Generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty." Verse. Matching strength with snow and frost, walking evenly through clouds and sleet, Zha Hui left the country. Zhang Wu crossed the bridge. Zhao and Cao's strategy was able to establish the Han. Zhao and Zhu wanted to avoid Yao completely. Favor and disgrace are disturbing. Profoundly trust in yourself. The real state one mixes tracks with fishermen and woodcutters. Today is the second day of our beautiful October Sesshin. A wonderful October session, and everybody is doing a wonderful job. Thank you very much for sitting with such a determination. Here's how it should go, right? Here's how it should go. When you get up in the morning on day two of the session, it should be, wait, I haven't even gotten started yet. It should be not too hot and not too cold, right? Sunny. Not too hot, not too cold. And when you come to the Zendo and you sit down on the cushion, it should be very comfortable. Okay? The Zendo should be at a, room temperature, you would say. And when you sit on the cushion, your legs shouldn't hurt too much. And your back shouldn't hurt, and you shouldn't be tired. And you should start going, 1, 2, 3, 4, yes? And then you would just sink down into beautiful samadhi, and you have bliss, right? Hour after hour of bliss. Beautiful, right? Then the bell rings, and it's time to have lunch for breakfast. We have breakfast, everything's in order, delicious breakfast, after the yes. And all the while, be like this. Be beautiful, right? And yet, you know, probably your day has not been like that. Is that true? In other words, when you got up this morning, you might have been a little tired. Yeah, you might have, the first couple of minutes, you might have thought, oh God, 4:30. And then you might have come into the Zendo, and when you went to cross your legs, one of your knees hurt. Okay? And possibly your back is sore, and you're trying to find a way to make the cushions support you properly, and they just won't do it. Okay? And you put them this way, and you put them that way, and no matter what you do, the darn things just don't hold you up properly. And possibly when you're sitting, your mind is very foggy or blurry because you're drifting in and out of sleep. And does this sound familiar? And you might think, damn it, you know, this is not what I signed up for. Or you might think, you know, this is very far from what I wanted. Yeah. This is, you know, one way to look at sashin is that it's a difficult experience. Yeah? I mean, we're sitting for 8 or 9 hours a day. It's 9 if you count the teisho. So it's a lot of zazen, and you know, basically you probably feel at times that you're being pushed to the limits of your endurance, and you may wonder, why the hell am I doing this? You know, why do I have to come here? Because, you know, it is possible to sit on your own, even if, you know, and you can have some very nice sits. You know, you don't have to get up at 4:30. You can get up at 8 o'clock, even. You know, you can get up at 8, have a little coffee and a donut or a bagel or something, and sit down and meditate, and you get up and, you know, your legs aren't sore, and you might come to the sit on a Thursday night and think, you know, well, this is just wonderful. Sit down and, you know, no pain and real bliss. And when you come to sashin, it might be quite different. You know, you might sit down on the cushion, and it's not bliss at all. It's just like this trudge up a mountaintop. Yeah. So see, you know, it's possible on a Thursday night or a Friday night to have a blissful sit. And here we are in this darn sashin, and every muscle in the body is hurting. And you might think, why am I doing this? When I can have my blissful sit without going through all this crap, you know? And in fact, you know, it's easier to get to the blissful sit without coming to sashin, actually. That's the truth. So, you know, there are people who have reached the conclusion that sashin is not where they want to be. I have actually talked to people who have told me, you know, I think I have better sits at home than I do at sashin. And I try to be persuasive about it, you know, and say, well, you know, it's like you're deepening your practice here. But there's a fundamental orientation that when people decide I'm not going to sashin because I can have more bliss when I don't go to sashin, I think there's a fundamentally mistaken orientation, but it's very deeply ingrained in how we think about life in general. How we think about life in general. One way to think about what we're doing in Zen is we're transcending. See, one way to think about what we're doing is we're transcending. And it's easy to think that way. I mean, you know, when you look at the ordinary world, it is very confused. I mean, not just confusing, but confused. If you look at our society, everybody from the president on down can seem very mixed up and clueless. Yeah? Right now, we're, you know, as everybody knows, we're involved in a war, which is like a nightmare realm, right? We don't know if we ever needed to go. We don't know when it will be over. A few days before the sashin, somebody released a some researchers at Johns Hopkins said that there were probably 600,000 people had died because of the American presence in Iraq. That's a huge number, like 600. Of course, the administration said, oh no. Well, you know, when people hear this, they're bound to feel that something is wrong with the world. Happen to be interested in the environment. Carlos isn't here, he's coming on Saturday, but He gave me this tape about how all the oil economy is going to collapse, right? And if you watch the tape even once, you start wanting to put food in your basement, you know, store up food. And you know, it's rational to be worried after you see this movie. I mean, as it turns out, some people have told me this kind of a little bit too extreme, you know, but some experts have told me that, you know, he's not the best economist in the world, so don't worry, don't store too much stuff in here. But it's worth being worried a little bit, right? Because, you know, we want to believe that we know what we're doing, we humans, but in a certain sense we kind of know that we don't. Yeah? And when our big institutions get rolling and start grinding people up or destroying the natural world, we begin to be rightfully nervous. Yeah? And this can carry over to our personal lives. When I was about 17, I had never really heard anything about Buddhism at all. But I read a book by a man named Thomas Merton, who was a Catholic monk. It was a book called The Seven Story Mountain. And it was not that interesting, actually. But it did excite me because he talked about leaving the ordinary world and entering a monastery, a Catholic monastery. And later, when I was in college, or in my second year of college, I had the opportunity to go up to a Trappist monastery in West Virginia and meet some of the monks, and they really aren't supposed to speak, and indeed they didn't speak. But we went up to visit, and there was somebody who was sort of like a gatekeeper at the monastery, and we went in and we did some chores, and then we left. And I was very impressed by their way of life. I have no idea what they did during the day, but it was clear to me that they had sort of walked away from the world, right? And they had actually left the world and taken a vow of silence. Actually, these Trappists promised, you know, they didn't speak. Imagine going through your whole life and never speaking. So they had really made a symbolic break with the world, and it really impressed me. And my life was such a mess, my personal life was such a mess. My parents, in my second year in school, my parents got divorced, and it was like a really bitter divorce. My parents, I love them both, but when it comes to their interactions, they were like the couple made in hell, and they just, they really were bad for each other in a lot of ways. They really worked at cross purposes all the time and never worked out their communication problems. And my brother and my sister and I have often talked about it. We just sometimes have laughed because we love them, but their relationship was just impossible. And there are so many days I can remember as a teenager, you know, with my mother crying in the kitchen and my father chain-smoking cigarettes out in the garage, and really, like, really unhappy marriage. Unbelievable. And in my second year of college, they got divorced, but instead of experiencing this as a kind of relief, it was like the whole world fell apart, because when they got divorced, they sold their house, and they both lived in these apartments, and my brother and sister went to live with my mother, and my father lived in a little apartment outside of Washington, D.C. And the arrangement was I was supposed to go stay with my dad. And, when I went to see my mother and my brother and sister, they were so unhappy in this little apartment. And they really were having a rough time. And then I went to see my dad, and he was so unhappy. And everybody I knew was unhappy. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And when I left, when I was in college, you know, in the dorms, everybody was going home for Christmas or the holidays anyway, and they were all going to go to their homes, you know. And I didn't really have any home. It was sort of depressing. And I just, you know, and then, you know, my father was having a lot of emotional problems because of his divorce. And at this time, the United States was at war, as usual, with was at war with Vietnam. So, you know, this was going on, and my father is was a military officer. He spent 6 years in Vietnam, and of course I was very strongly opposed to Vietnam. So we would, you know, when I was living with him, if we weren't careful, we would get into these huge arguments. So, you know, at that point in my life, the Trappist monastery seemed like a really great idea. You know what I mean? Everywhere I looked, it just seemed like disorder and chaos and unhappiness. And and indeed, it was. You know, it was. It wasn't an illusion. It really was. You know, pretty much everybody I knew at that time in my personal life, my family, pretty much everybody was unhappy. And the country was unhappy because we were in a crazy, unnecessary war that was costing tens of thousands of lives. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And the society seemed so misguided in so many ways, you know. Even then, believe it or not, there were people predicting global warming. And since then, of course, we've done a great deal to solve the problem. So, you know, I thought I would love to go and live with the Trappists in their monastery and become a monk myself. And I actually did research, and unfortunately, I really couldn't, I myself have respect for the Trappists, but I couldn't get into their religious philosophy, to tell you the truth. So I didn't do it. But I dreamed. I thought it would be so sweet to get away. And when I came across some books on Zen, I really read them very eagerly because that philosophy was more appealing to me. It spoke to me more directly. And there was still this idea of getting away from this craziness. This absolute craziness, which is here, which is real. And, you know, one way to think about what we're doing is getting away. You know, we're getting away from all that pain and suffering, you know, and getting to a place that's happy and bright and pleasant. And so, you know, when we come to Sesshin, we want it to be happy and bright and pleasant. We don't want it to be painful, dark, and difficult, and cold. Right? Sometimes it's even cold. So it's sort of a disappointment when Sesshin is like that, because a lot of us, maybe you're different, but when I first came to Sesshin, I had motives of getting away from this craziness, and really a lot of pain around it. And a lot of people understand the sort of so-called spiritual journey that way, you know. Many people who grow up in the West really do believe that life is a place where we are put to suffer and be tested. And then if we pass the test, we'll go, as we say, we go to a better place. A better place. My grandmother was a very religious person. She was an extremely true believer and a wonderful person. My grandmother was a kind, as compassionate a person as I've ever known. And yet she had a lot of suffering in her life. She her oldest daughter died, my grandmother's oldest daughter died when the daughter was 18. Her name was Pearl, like pearl, and not like a pearl, gem. And she, my grandparents were farmers, and they had very little money and lived far from any city. And my aunt, I never met her, but she was just coming into her blossoming into her life, and she had appendicitis attack and died of infection. And my grandmother had another child who died in childbirth. And my grandparents lost their farm because of the financial collapse in the 1930s. And they both had to go to work as workers. My grandmother went to the governor's mansion in New York State. And worked as a cook. And the governor, she's an excellent cook. And my grandfather worked as a hired laborer, agricultural laborer. And so my grandmother had to split up her children, and my mother lived with her aunt because they couldn't afford to take care of the children. So my grandmother always had faith that she was being tested. And she believed, she always used to say, when I die, I'm going to go to a better place, better place. And we can have that attitude too a little bit. You know, sometimes we think we want to go to a better place. We want to get away from all this madness and go to a better place. You know, in Indian thinking too, actually, even though Indian religious sensibility has a kind of a wonderful openness to the world, there's also this this better place mindset, you know. Like one of the things I think is so cool about India is that you know, they have temples for monkeys. Right? I just think that's great. In other words, you know, monkeys belong in this world, don't they? And if they belong here, you should honor them. So there's a monkey temple. I think that's great. And also, you know, there's actually a temple for rats. There are temples for rats in India. This is, for Americans, this is like totally creepy. But it's wonderful, right? I mean, actually, my wife had a pet rat and loved it. And she was heartbroken when it finally died. And my wife loves rats. And Genki Roshi loved rats, as a matter of fact. Genki Roshi, when our first session, we had rats in the kitchen, and everybody was thinking, we've got to get the rats out of there. And Genki Roshi said, oh, if rats live here, it must be a very good place. You know, rats would never live in a place that was unhealthy. So, okay. So everybody said, okay. Roshi likes rats. All right. You know, so we just covered up all the food and made sure everything was locked down. And I swear to you, we would hear the rats scuffling sometimes. They'd be quarreling. And we could hear them squeaking in the wall. Basically, I love the Indian spirit of world-embracing generosity. When you have a temple for rats and you have a temple for monkeys, but there's another aspect to Indian spirituality, and that is this idea of transcendence. Right? So sometimes in Indian religion, also there's like the image of the lotus. See, the image of the lotus grows out of the filth and the mud, the confusion and unhappiness. And it transcends earthly life and goes up to a higher level, higher plane. So this is like two aspects. One side of Indian culture says that everything should be embraced, but there's this other very powerful side that says purity, it comes out of filth, and the highest good is like a beyond this world, right? So when we practice Zen, it's possible to have this mindset, which we find in the East and in the West. We find it both places a little bit. My grandmother said, when I die, I'm going to a better place. And there are certainly gurus in India who say, you know, this world is like a dream or a nightmare. And when we do our yoga, we'll transcend, we'll ascend into a higher plane. And that's a way to practice, you know. But please don't practice that way. See, because it doesn't really make any sense, does it? It doesn't make a darn bit of sense. Why do we even live, you know, if this is all just a bunch of crap, you know? In other words, we cut the world right in half if we do that. We make a divided world if we say, this world's the bad place, and there's some other place that's a good place. Yeah? Or if we say this is the filth, and the heaven is the flower. This is like, this means the world is cut right in two. It's always bad and good, right and wrong, pure and impure. This is what we do to ourselves and to the world. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but it's very tempting to think along those lines. So, you know, when you sit on the cushion, sometimes you can sit down on the cushion and enter a blissful state. That's everything, you know. When you start working with the breath perception koan, and you keep working with it for a while, eventually what happens to you is you experience this state of like disembodied awareness. It's like body and mind fall away, and you're just present in the moment, hovering in this kind of blissful cocoon. And it's so beautiful and sweet. Samadhi, these early samadhis are so sweet and beautiful. And we pursue them in many ways. I mean, not just on the cushion. Sometimes people like to have a drink, you know? And you have a nice drink of bourbon or something. My dad was quite a drinker. And when he would drink, he would become mellow and calm. He was in bourbon samadhi. And that's how he got to samadhi. And you know, other people can have other kinds of samadhis. But the point is that what we call samadhi is really just a focused mind. And self-awareness begins to disappear. And when the mind is not divided from the object of its awareness, everything becomes much more beautiful and pleasant. And you have to be able to enter this state if you wish to practice the way of the Buddhas and founders of Chan. But you can't linger in samadhi, and even though we all want to, we all want bliss, and none of us want the discomfort. Yeah. But then that means we don't really want to be alive, right? We want to hover in a disembodied state, somewhere between heaven and earth, yeah, where there's no cold, and no heat, and no pain, and nothing. It's just pleasant. This beautiful, pleasant sensation, sort of like a permanent, sort of just permanent joy. Joy is probably too strong a word. So permanent happiness. No pain. No gain, true, but no pain. So this is very tempting. It was very tempting for me. It was one of the reasons it took me so long to answer the mukha. Because I was addicted to this light samadhi experience. I really loved that pleasant, blissful feeling. And I really wanted to get out of this bad world and I really wanted to go to a better place and transcend and be with the lotus and not down in the mud. But this is a divided mind. See, this is like a divided mind. And every time you find yourself feeling this way, you need to sort of get a grip on yourself. Because it means that the world that we know is just like a pointless. You know? Now, you know, another way to look at the world is that this is not the mud, this is the lotus. See, the universe has struggled for billions of years to produce this. See? And it seems like a crazy darn world, doesn't it? It's the craziest place. And yet, you know, and yet, there's something about it which is so alive. If you can free yourself from your fear and attachment. See, there's something about this crazy place which is so destructive sometimes. There's something about it which is amazing and actually beautiful. It's not necessarily pleasant, but it's so exciting, it's so alive, and it breaks your heart, and when your heart is breaking, compassion fills you up. See, so it's a different way to live, right? You know, one way is like, get me out of here. Get me out of here. And that it's possible to practice that way. And boy, I practiced that way for so many years. You know, I just thought, get me out of here. Get me out of my unhappy family. Get me out of my unhappy job. Get me out, and later, get me out of graduate school, please. You know, there must be. I wanted to live in a monastery in Tibet, you know, somewhere high in the mountains where the grass is always green, you know, and central heating, and so on. And not in Baltimore, Maryland, or in D.C., or Seattle, Washington. And I wanted to sit on the cushion and have bliss, bliss, bliss. Give me bliss, yeah? And go to a better place. But then, you know, this world is so ungrateful. You know, this world is the universe is toiled for billions of years to produce this crazy world. And in this crazy world, it's possible to become Buddhas. See, it is, it's possible. But, you know, when you think back about the time of the Buddha, you might think, well, back then, everybody was a good guy, right? See, everybody was, back when the Buddha was around, everybody was a good guy, you know? And basically, everybody was waiting for the Buddha, and when he was born, they said, oh, thank you, you're here, finally, you know, it wasn't like that. You know, the place was a wreck. You know, the Buddha's own family were annihilated by like a ruthless dictator. This koan starts out with a little statement. It says, better to be sunk forever than to seek the liberation of the saints. See? Devadatta experienced the bliss of the third meditation heaven. In other words, Devadatta is the Buddha's cousin who tried to kill him. See, when the Buddha set up the Sangha, everybody in the Sangha wasn't a good guy. As usual, they were human beings. So there were all these confusions, intrigues, jealousies. And the Buddha's cousin at one time wanted to be his top student. And then when the Buddha said, I don't think you're ready to be the top student, Devadatta tried to have the Buddha assassinated. Yeah, this really happened. So, Devadatta can go into deep samadhi and can experience the bliss of the third meditation heaven, see. He can drop body and mind and be in bliss all the time, and yet he wants to kill the Buddha, see. Something's wrong with that state, you see. Udraka Ramaputra was one of the Buddha's two major teachers. Udraka Ramaputra was a great meditation master who taught complete emptiness. As a highest goal, the highest goal. And he really taught meditation as a path to annihilation of everything. So so that you're in a complete state of voidness. Right? But the Buddha didn't stay with the Udraka Vamaputra. He said, this is not enlightenment, because the world is still cut in two. So basically, this world is a wonderful opportunity to become Buddha, which is our real goal. You know, as I was saying the other day, our goal is not to become not to have Daikensho. That's just a step on the path. Our real goal is to become Buddhas, right? And you can't become Buddha if you don't live in this world of confusion and suffering and difficulty, of cold and hot and so on. This is how it's done. You can't do it without it. There are no Buddhas in realms other than this one. This is the big machine for producing Buddhas, right? You need to have a world where your family are exterminated, and you need to have a world where your cousin tries to kill you. You know, when the Buddha established the Sangha, you could think, well, everybody was nice and enlightened. It wasn't true. At one time, there were so many arguments going on in the Sangha that the Buddha left. He just said, you guys have got to work it out. I'm going to go live in the hills by myself. He said, I'll be back when you settle this, right? And they figured out how to get along with each other. But basically, it was chaos. It was confusion. And it's terrifying, of course. It's frightening. Nobody wants to be waiting for Christmas break and you don't have a house to go home to. Nobody wants to go home and see your mother and father fighting it out. And nobody wants to get sick. And nobody wants to lose his job. Now we think, oh man, take me to a better place. Please take me to a better place. And then you come to Sashin and you sit on the cushion and, oh damn, I've got pain in these damn legs, you know? I thought I was going to go to a better place. It's like, please don't misunderstand what this is all about. See, that we need to enter deep samadhi. We need to enter emptiness. And then this world with its cold and hot, its confusion and fear, this is like our rice. We eat this rice and we become awake. And you need the bitter and the sweet. You need the cold and the hot. You need it all. And it's a big mistake to think that we're escaping from anything. We're purifying body, heart, and mind in order to embrace the world with every pore of our being. Whatever happens this next moment is Buddha itself. It's Buddha itself. The pain in your legs is Buddha. And it's not in the way, it's the path. It's the path. And this is the wish fulfilling gem. This world is the wish fulfilling gem. As I said yesterday, koan is like a kind of a special kind of game. Koan says, hey, would you like to go on a treasure hunt? He goes, oh, treasure hunt, yes. You know? And so you go round and round and round and round and then you wind up this way. Right on your cushion, right here. This is the treasure. This beautiful world. This beautiful. It's crazy. It's crazy. It's totally crazy. But this is where Buddha's are produced. Yeah. And you meet people who are very deeply awake and they have problems. Yes, people have problems. That's also part of life. I have my problems and you have your problems. You have your barriers, I have my barriers. You know, one of the most successful Zen teachers in the United States was a man named Maizumi Roshi. And Maizumi Roshi was a Soto monk who came here. His family were all, his brothers were all Soto priests, I should say. And his father was a Soto priest. It was a Japanese, you know, like a family of priests. It's kind of strange. In China, this doesn't happen, but in Japan, the family temple was taken care of by generations of these priests. And one of the brothers was Maizumi Roshi, and he came to Los Angeles and started the Los Angeles Zen Center. And he's been tremendously successful. Bernie Glassman Roshi is one of his students, and Jan Bays in Oregon, and practically any place in the United States, you'll run into one of Maizumi Roshi's Dharma heirs. And he really had a lot of integrity. He did an excellent job. He was really an excellent teacher. It might surprise you to know that Maizumi Roshi had a drinking problem. Yeah. So this is interesting, isn't it? Because when people think of, we would be disappointed if we found out that the Dalai Lama has a drinking problem. And I'm sure he doesn't. Or at least I hope he doesn't. Right? But the Dalai Lama probably has some kind of a problem. You know? He probably does. Maybe not, but he probably has a tiny problem, but he still has a problem. You know? And Maizumi was in many ways a great Zen teacher and a deeply realized person. But he had a problem he struggled with all his life, which was alcoholism. And he was a good friend of my teacher. Maizumi would sometimes come up and stay with Kangan Webb in Malibu. And, Maizumi had a huge Zen center. And he had a lot of students, like a lot. And it was chaos and very difficult to deal with a lot of times. And at some point he got into this bad habit of drinking, and he created many problems for himself. And it's possible to say, well, he was just a phony or something like that, but it's not so. It's more complicated than that. He had a heavy weight to carry, but he was never completely resolved his issue with alcohol. But the struggle made him a very good teacher. It made him a very compassionate person. And it's possible to be face to face with enlightened mind and still have personal flaws that you're not able fully to overcome. And that's the truth. But you have to keep trying. That's your job, right? And the struggle with our personal problems is what makes it possible for our minds to be full of light and compassion. You know? It's that struggle with our obstacle that helps us to become Buddhas. So even though it's a personal defect of Maizumi that he drank, his struggle may have made him a much better, much deeper person, because he knew what it was like to have something you can't just walk away from. And it's a defect, right? It was a defect. It's like a chip on a beautiful tea bowl. It's a defect. There's no question about it. And you don't want to have defects. You want to try to be as good a person as you can be. You don't want to do things that cloud your mind or degrade you. But on the other hand, we all have defects. If you start from the standpoint that this is about becoming a perfect being, you're going to be unhappy. Now, this is really not about becoming a perfect being. It's about becoming Buddha. And the Buddha is something bigger than perfection. Yeah. So Buddha's perfection and imperfection. Yeah. So anyway, if you have a pain in your legs, don't feel that it's a big deal. It's just there to help you wake up. And if you're sitting on your cushion and you would like to be in deep, blissful samadhi and you feel annoyed and pissed off, So happy for you. You know? So happy. That's the best situation. Right? It's really good. Because something can happen then. Something can happen. You can really wake up. If you get up at 9 and you have a little breakfast and you sit on your cushion and you have a blissful sit till 10 or 11, then you go out and do whatever, nothing can happen. Nothing can happen. Don't kid yourself. I mean, that daily practice is important. Daily practice is so important. But really, if you practice Zen for those little blissful moments, you're not on the road to awakening. Not the road. That's not the path. So what does this have to do with a white rabbit? As Dongshan and his spiritual uncle Mi were walking along, they saw a white rabbit run by in front of them. White rabbit. What is that white rabbit? Well, you'll have to tell me when you do the koan. What is that white rabbit? You're walking through, you're walking through all of these brambles, tangles. It's like you're going through the bushes, and the bushes are all, you can't get through easily. They grab at your legs, you're trying to get through, and they're grabbing at your arms, and there's thorns, and you think, let me through here. And you see something running through the white rabbit. Oh, the Buddha, in the middle of all those tangles. Just for a minute. Just got to go. Dongshan. He said, that was fast. Did you see that? Buddha. Dongshan said, how? It's like a commoner being made into a prime minister. It's like a lotus growing up into the sun out of filth. Dongshan says, no. Wait around. This is the lotus.